Chapter 15, Planning and Programming. If we observe contemporary life, a curious contradiction presents itself. Planning and programming are often talked about today, and much economic, social, and technical planning is being done. On the other hand, separate individuals often live with no well-defined personal plan, and without having a clear and conscious life program. Yet a fundamental condition for successful planning of all kinds is the planning and programming of the personal life, primarily in a psychological sense, i.e. in the sense of carrying out one's individual psychosynthesis and the various interpersonal and social psychosyntheses. This personal planning must be done in accordance with the general rules and techniques appropriate to planning of any other kind. Therefore, let us briefly examine these rules and techniques. The most important rule is to formulate, clearly and precisely, the goal to be reached, and then to retain it unswervingly in mind throughout all the stages of the execution, which are often long and complex. This is no easy thing. Indeed, one may say that it presents great difficulty, since in man there is a constant tendency to pay excessive attention to the means he must employ to gain his end, even to the point of making him lose sight of it. The means ever tend to become the ends in themselves, and when this happens, man becomes enslaved by the means he has chosen to employ. Nowhere can this be seen more clearly than in the current much-debated problem of the interaction between man and machine. In its essential terms, this problem, or better, this relationship, can be formulated thus. Man creates and constructs machines in order that they may increase his power and capacity in the actions designed to achieve his ends. Thus, the intended function and value of the machine is purely instrumental and relative to the purpose for which it has been constructed. But often, man very often lets himself be bewitched by his machines, overvaluing them, and instead of possessing them, he ends up being possessed by them. The car affords striking evidence of this. The true and proper function of the car is to provide faster and more comfortable means of arriving at a place that we desire to go for a given purpose. Yet little by little, man has unwittingly made the car an object of prestige, a status symbol, a means of self-assertion, an outlet for the repressed tendencies of his life. The results have reached the grotesque. Rather than using the power of our technology to increase the safety of the car and reduce its pollution, we have needlessly increased its bulk power and therefore fuel consumption. This has given no real benefit, but on the contrary, has helped to create such a general traffic and parking congestion and to make of the car such an environmental menace that its original value as a fast and comfortable means of transportation is rapidly reaching the vanishing point. Clearly, our technology is not at fault, as some people tend to feel. The fault is rather in the uses we made of that technology, when we failed to keep in mind the original goal or purpose. The phenomenon is similar to that to what occurs in connection with other means, money, which also tends to easily become an end in itself through the attachment it arouses. And so we find the tendency to amass money without employing it usefully, as misers have done in all ages. Therefore, I repeat, a vigilant and energetic will is indispensable for maintaining the means in their place, for always being a master of them, while using only those that truly serve the intended purpose and to the extent that they serve it. This is a fundamental rule of a right program. Another basic consideration concerns the possibility of a given program being realized, in other words, its feasibility. A frequent error is to conceive plans and programs whose magnitude would demand capacities, circumstances, and resources we are very far from having at our disposal. The making of grandiose plans is something pleasant, even fascinating, and this I think we all experience. The world teems with idealists and dreamers who conceive, or more accurately, are dominated by beautiful but impractical programs. If one comes to realize that his program is too ambitious, he should be willing to acknowledge the fact, even if he has already started the program. To do otherwise would end only in frustration and other ill effects. Our organism rebels at the impossible, and many people have been victims of the compulsive Victorian will. One must be prepared, after adequate consideration and testing, to adjust his aspirations and programs rationally and cheerfully to realistic possibilities. This brings us to another rule in planning, the establishment, whenever possible, of right cooperation. A frequent reason for the failure of so many plans lies in the fact that people want to carry out their programs themselves. They themselves want to be at the centre of the planned organisation. Thus, they are often guilty of duplication through trying to do what others are already doing, sometimes with much greater resources and possibilities. What are needed are the wisdom and humility to acknowledge what has already been done or is in preparation in the same direction as our projects, and then to cooperate, or perhaps associate ourselves with those who are doing or propose to do the same thing. In this context, I may recall an occurrence that has various psychologically interesting aspects. The second half of the 19th century saw the beginning of the construction of railway sleeping cars in America. There were two rival firms in the field, Carnegie and Westinghouse. The competition between them caused Carnegie to recognise that it would be far more profitable to combine rather than fight his competitor. At first, Westinghouse was somewhat stiff and suspicious when Carnegie asked to meet him and discuss the matter, but little by little he warmed to the idea of amalgamating the two firms. All of a sudden, however, he stopped and asked, "But what is the new firm to be called?" "Westinghouse, naturally." Whereupon Westinghouse said, "Done." Little comment is needed, I think. Carnegie made light of any question of a more propos or name in consideration of the outcome's usefulness and common interest. The other's ambition was gratified, and so they came to an agreement. If the rule of cooperation can be successfully used by businessmen for material aims, we should be willing to use it for other aims, especially higher ones. The possibility of cooperation and its benefits are frequently ignored by those having high motives. Those with zeal to serve the world are too often also possessed by the desire to see themselves serving the world. Thus, one frequently observes needless competition over secondary matters among schools of thought in education, psychology, and many other useful fields. A greater willingness for cooperative service and practical synthesis, implemented by concentrating on the similarities and not on the differences, would be much more productive. A fourth rule of planning pertains to recognizing, distinguishing, and giving proper sequence to the various phases of planning. They are formulation, programming, structuring, project making, model, or pilot, project. A good illustration of these stages is the case of a student of mine who wanted to develop his ability to operate from motives other than the materialistic ones, safety, security, eminence, riches, which were driving him in a compulsive way into depression. His aim was to embrace higher values in his actions, but he feared that in doing so he would lose material comforts. After deliberating, we decided to plan a strategy to get him in touch with his higher values and gradually allow him to embrace them. This general formulation was the first stage of planning. The next stage was programming. The program called for beginning slowly, in a non-threatening manner, by gradually reducing the time spent on material things. This was done in a number of steps. First, the student was asked to become fully aware of how his materialistic drives influenced him. Then he was asked to choose which ones he would like to reduce. Effective planning required this gradual approach, and good structuring dictated that awareness be followed by choice, rather than having choice early in the process. The project called for, among other things, ways of expanding awareness of the materialistic drives. We settled on an experimental pilot project, which consisted of an evening review to be made by the student before retiring of the sway that materialistic thoughts, feelings, or actions had upon him during the day. Once he recognised the extent of their harmful influence, this awareness became more than sufficient motive to implement the intention to reduce them. Thus, he gradually was able to create some space in his life, and we were ready to deal with the main goal he had always had in mind, that of getting in touch with the part of himself that truly did hold higher values. The project was then expanded to include ways he could use to bring those values more and more actively into his life. It was at this point that he had the realization that acting from this higher place within him in no way meant that he had to renounce all material comforts. Thus, we can see that formulation stands for the initial stage in a general sense, for the conception of the plan in its broad lines. Programming represents a greater precision and more concrete development of the plan, particularly in the early phases of its execution. The difference may be said to correspond to that between strategic and tactical plans. Having formulated a well-defined and structured program, one can pass on the working out of a definite project with all the practical data that relate to it. An adequately developed project can then be followed by an experimental pilot project. Its central aim is to test the project, and as such, it can be very instructive, since practical experience often gives different results from those expected. While these stages imply a gradual step-by-step process, they must all be kept in mind together. Mountain climbing is a good example of this. The peak to be climbed has first to be selected, then the best route to the summit, which may have been circuitous to avoid obstacles, and last, once the climb begins, the choice of footholds, which can determine the difference between safety and falling. It may be said that trifocal vision is required, that is, the perception and retention in mind of the distant goal and purpose. The survey of the intermediate stages, which extend from the point of departure to arrival, and the awareness of the next step to be taken. This view of the whole, graduated at the same time in its different stages, can be applied to every kind of task and considered a spatial conception in both an objective and symbolic sense. But as important, if not more so, is the temporal factor, that is, the consideration of the timing and duration each stage should have. As we know, time and space are intimately related as two aspects of the same continuum. Therefore, it is a matter of implementing each stage at the right time and for the necessary period. Every phase has its most favourable, even its only possible, moment for execution, which may be expressed in the paradoxical phrase, "The impossible of today is tomorrow's possible. Today's possible is the impossible of tomorrow." Another requirement to be considered is the flexibility of the plan, that is, its susceptibility to modification as new developments occur. Life is full of the unexpected, and however prescient one tries to be, something unforeseen very often crops up. So we must be ready to modify and adapt our plans. Flexibility can be seen in its simplest and most accessible form in chess, in which a player plans a series of moves to checkmate his opponent, but must be on the alert to change his plan in response to the offensive moves of his opponent, who has a similar plan. To achieve all this demands reflection, a fine sense of proportion and good judgment, all of which can be summed up in one simple word, wisdom. But unflagging attention, vigilance, patience and persistence, which are qualities of the will, are also needed, which shows that planning plays an integrating part in the process of willing, in effective volition. All these rules can and should be applied in psychosynthesis. Individual psychosynthesis can be said to consist essentially in the actualization of one's own ideal model. The role of planning in both the discovery and the actualization of the ideal model is fully discussed in Psychosynthesis, pages 166 through 177. Careful planning and patient execution of a life plan and sub-plans are necessary if one is to fulfill his personal existence and become all that he can. Needless to say, planning also belongs in the transpersonal or spiritual phase of psychosynthesis. In carrying out a psychosynthetic program, we should apply the general rules of planning, but we should also be careful to include in the process the phases of elaboration and gestation, allowing them the time they need, without interference. Moreover, the individual life plan must be coordinated, integrated, and harmonized with plans that include other people. Individual psychosynthesis is not, and cannot be, an end in itself, since each one of us is closely linked in life with the other persons and groups around us. We can begin this process by formulating and carrying out plans and programs enabling us to play our various roles in human relations and to fulfill the various functions they demand. The life of a family, regarded as a psychological entity, for example, can be consciously planned and organized. Naturally, affection and goodwill constitute its basis, but these are not sufficient. Then there are the roles associated with work, which frequently involve relations with superiors, colleagues, and subordinates. There are the community roles arising out of membership in social groups and participation in their specific activities, political, economic, cultural, and humanitarian. Some of the techniques of individual psychosynthesis can be usefully applied in planning and carrying out interpersonal and group psychosynthesis. Among those of more general use, I may mention the techniques for the transformation of energies, the techniques of the methodological use of images, and that of imaginative training. Conversely, interpersonal and group relations are external activities can be utilized as occasions and instruments for inner development and actualization. A note on social psychosynthesis. Social psychosynthesis raises the problem, much discussed at the present time, of the relations between the individual and society. Most of the writers who have dealt with the subject have done so in a controversial way, contrasting the two and regarding them as almost necessarily in conflict. Yet in this case, as in many other instances, it is more often a matter of dealing with a polarity. The principles expounded in my pamphlet, Balancing and Synthesis of Opposites, New York, 1972, can find here a useful application. There I have used a diagram to show the relationship between each pair of opposite poles and their ways of balancing, in reference to the problem of individual versus society. We have the following triangular relationships. And here we have a drawing of a triangle. At the top tip of the triangle is the word transformation. At the bottom left tip, we have the word conformity. The bottom right tip, we have rebellion. And in the middle place, adaptation. Returning to text. At the extremities of the base of the triangle are the two opposite poles, conformity and rebellion. The middle point of the base may be taken to represent a position of compromise, allowing to a degree of manoeuvring, but limiting and unsatisfactory as a lasting solution. Yet there exists a point above, equidistant from both poles and at a higher level, from which one can be an integral and effective member of society while maintaining his independence fully. This position stands for action in and on society in order to transform it. The synthetic formula for resolving this problem has been given in the Bible. Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. A way of expressing this in modern psychological terms might be, concede to society what is necessary and appropriate, and also act in society as a constructive force for improving it. This can be done by first reserving one's own integrity and independence, cultivating the inner garden. It is thus not a question of passively submitting to social conditioning, but first of protecting oneself from it, without resorting either to violent rebellion or to withdrawal, and then actively seeking to modify and improve present social life in every possible way. It is important not only for society's good, but also for the individual's satisfaction, that he experience this inner independence. The liberty to which the individual really aspires, more or less consciously, is chiefly a psychological and spiritual freedom, but its achievement depends in large measure on himself. Groups and society can obstruct it in a variety of ways with their pressures, but cannot really prevent it. One can be inwardly free even while assenting to the performance of his functions and to playing his parts in the family and society in accordance with the situation in which he finds himself. Here also the techniques of psychosynthesis can be of great assistance, especially those of identification and acting as if. Using such techniques, one can always have inner space, that is, making room in consciousness and temporal space, or some free time in which an independent individual life can be lived. And this does not demand long periods of time and special conditions. It is a matter of utilizing the dimension of intensity. A half hour lived at a high level intensely can give value, meaning, and justification to a whole day. Finally, there is a higher and broader kind of planning, which is in reality the most important. It is that of integrating the individual plan with the universal plan, to which I referred earlier. While we are unable to be aware of the complete scope of that plan and its great mystery, we can at least know something of it and glimpse its broad lines, especially its evolutionary direction, and thus recognize it is the direction of the greatest good. That is what counts. Our first goal is not to discern the point of arrival, but to place ourselves in the right current, on the right road. Here also, and above all here, wisdom is necessary for harmoniously interweaving the individual plan and the universal plan, and will is needed for retaining a firm control of the rudder and proceeding on a straight course. End of chapter 15.